we have to anticipate some of the changes that are going to be taking place in our whole economy, but especially with regard to food and agriculture. You know, there have been people, of course, in the past who have understood how important it was to maintain the health of our soil, but they've pretty much been ignored. You know, Sir Albert Howard made this point, you know, back in the early 1990s. And if you look at that in context, you know, we actually, you know, in a sense, you have to go back to the Enlightenment and the impact which that had on how we saw ourselves in relationship to nature. You know, pretty much we saw ourselves then separate from nature, and we had to do whatever we could to force nature to meet our goals. Rene Descartes said we had to become the masters and possessors of nature, and so that built a kind of culture. But in the terms of agriculture, you know, going back to, you know, the beginning of the Neolithic period, when we really started to do agriculture for the first time, so about 10,000 year period there, and during most of that time, we were able to do agriculture in what, you know, basically we call a slash and burn approach now. You know, we would destroy the perennials, whether grasses or trees in a place, and burn it, and then the ashes from that burn plus the natural fertility in the soil would enable us to grow food fairly productively for, you know, 5 or 6 years. And then we would deplete natural fertility in the soil, and then we'd slash and burn another place and lay fallow, you know, for maybe 10 years, and then we could go back and grow it. So that's pretty much how we did, how we produced our food in those early eras of agriculture. And then in 1840, well, it was actually in the 1830s, Eustace von Liebig, who was a brilliant German scientist and the one who came up with the concept of organic chemistry and developed that as a discipline. And then in 1840, he published an essay in which he applied that skill, that organic chemistry, to agriculture. And he came up with the concept of the law of the minimum. What he was interested in doing, and quite understandably, was, you know, to get beyond the slash and burn kind of agriculture. And the way you could do that was simply by putting in primarily nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, the big three. And then you could have these incredible yields without having to worry about, you know, the natural aspects of soil. And then by 1843, the first fertilizer companies developed, and then we went on that path of an input agriculture. Sir Albert Howard, who referred to this as the NPK mentality, and he indicated that the NPK mentality was a form of banditry because it would steal healthy soil from future generations. And then he came up with the concept of the law of return instead of the law of the minimum, where we have to learn how to compost all of our wastes and get them back into the soil to restore the natural health of the soil. But of course, the simplicity of the NPK mentality and that law of the minimum was so attractive, and particularly as the industrial economy emerged, which was primarily about maximum efficient production for short-term economic return, and the NPK mentality was simply much more attractive for that. And so that's the path that we then took. Now, back to your question, why can't we just continue down that path? And well, the problem is that, and Ernest Schuske referred to the fact that the neocaloric era is coming to an end now because it's entirely based on old calories. They're old calories because they're not renewable. And so he referred to this era of roughly the early 1900s to our present time as the neocaloric era. And he argued already back in 1989 when he published his book on this, he said that we have to recognize that the neocaloric era is going to be a very short period of time in the timeline of human history because these are old calories and we're using them up, and when they're gone, we're going to have to figure out a new way to produce our food. And this is where we get back to restoring the biological health of soil is an absolutely foundational aspect of that from my point of view. Because, you know, we all of the data that I've seen, if you just look at it in terms of phosphorus, and it's one of the three NPKs, we only have about 20 years of phosphorus left in the United States at the rate that we're using rock phosphate. And those costs, of course, will begin to spiral up as we deplete them more. And in fact, if you just look at the history, in 1960, farmers were buying phosphorus for $80 a ton, and now it's $700 a ton. And so we can imagine that, 10 or 20 years from now, it'll be $2,500 a ton. And then in addition to that, of course, one of the other key inputs we have been so dependent on in our current food system is cheap fossil fuels. That cheap energy won't be there. So we have to begin to think about how are we going to produce our food system, you know, when crude oil gets to $300 a barrel, phosphorus $2,500 a ton. We only have half the amount of fresh water that we've been used to, because we also have thought that water was kind of an unlimited resource and cheap, but we're now using 70% of our fresh water resources just for agriculture irrigation. Because again, if you don't have healthy soil, then, you know, basically most of our soils in the industrial world now only absorb a half inch of rainwater an hour, and then the water starts to run off. Well, farmers who have even just been using cover crops as a way of restoring biological health of soil, farmers like Gabe Brown up in North Dakota, he's been doing cover crops in his rotation now for the last 12 years, and he claims that his soil now absorbs 8 inches of rainwater an hour. So these are the kinds of things we have to think about. How do we have soil that's regenerative, that's restored as the process of being used, that absorbs more moisture and restores more moisture, especially as we move into climate change with more floods and more droughts and more severe weather events. And soil is absolutely foundational to this. And the second piece of the foundation is biodiversity, because if you have huge monocultures, then you need all of the inputs in order to sustain them. Now, again, the interesting thing here to me is that the United Nations is also beginning to recognize this. And as we all know, they designated 2015 as the International Year of Soil. And now 2016, they've designated as the International Year of Pulses. And if you can start to incorporate pulses into like a corn-soybean rotation, you know, pulses are legumes, they can diversify our food system, and they begin to move in a different kind of direction.
You say neocaloric.
Yeah.
I always get confused about that.
The reason that Ernest Schuske used that is because that 10,000-year period when we were doing agriculture on a slash-and-burn basis, we now call the Neolithic Revolution.
Okay.
And so he, probably even with a little bit of a sense of humor, says it's now the neocaloric. In other words, now we're totally based, totally dependent on these old calories.
You know, Fred, I grew up on a farm too, and I grew up on a farm west of Peoria. And one thing I remember growing up is that in our case, the closer you were to 116, the deeper and blacker the soil was. And as you moved away from the road, you went out back into timber soils. And you could see the prosperity of the farm based on the soil. The closer you got to the timber soil, the less likely that the barn was painted and the fences were painted, and it was just kind of upset because the soil supported people better when the soil was strong.
Right.
And even then, when I grew up, we were rotating, you know,
you
had mostly corn, but you also had alfalfa and oats. And in a four-year rotation, you never went more than 2 years with corn. It's so different, the soil types all over the country. And today, both of us fly around the country a lot, and many of the people that might be listening are flying around the country. And if they get a window seat and they look out, and you can just see from 30,000 feet up that the land is extremely different from one coast to the next.
Sure.
And you go over deserts, or if you go into that deep black soil around Champaign, Illinois or somewhere, how do you accommodate the philosophy and the science that you're talking about and apply it to all these different soil types all over the world?
Yeah, well, there's actually a very interesting new book that's just out about that, or some aspects of the foundation of that, as I would put it. John Takara, who is a very amazing researcher. You know, he wrote a book, I think it was published in 2006, called In the Bubble. And that book was about the internet. And this was at a time when the internet was really emerging. And so many people involved in the internet were saying, well, this is so great. Now none of us have to get on a plane anymore because we can do everything on the internet and everything online. And John Takara said, well, you know, as we all know, that didn't happen. And then he coined this phrase. He said, and the reason is because sometimes you just have to be there. You know, we need those face-to-face interactions. Well, he's now written a new book called How to Thrive in the Next Economy. And what he's pointing out is that, and this is based on his travels around the world, that around the world now there is a new economy, and it's not just about food and agriculture, but food and agriculture is at the heart of this economy in many ways. And these are economies now where instead of the unified global economy, you know, where we can produce, if we can produce it cheaper in China and ship it to the United States or whatever, you know, that's the way we're going to do it. Well, he's the new economy that he's seeing to emerge now is what he calls bioregionalism. And that's where people gather together in their own ecological communities and they develop an economy that's appropriate to place and the kind of food and agriculture that's appropriate to that place. And it's a very fascinating, again, this is not based just on theory, this is based on what's already happening out there. The reason I think that that's really important is because of the point that you made. You know, if I can use North Dakota as an example for a moment, North Dakota really has three different bioregions. There's the bioregion in the eastern part of the state, which is in the Red River Valley, pretty flat area, it's a tall grass prairie ecology. And then you get about 70 miles west of the eastern North Dakota border, you enter into a second ecology, which is the mixed grass prairie region. And this is where the prairie pothole region is. And the land is hillier. All of the soils, of course, were glaciated. They were deposited by the glacier thousands of years ago. But in that mixed grass prairie region, there's much more tall grass prairie region. It's a lot like Iowa, you know, it's pretty specialized, corn, beans, you know, et cetera. When you get into the mixed grass prairie region, it's much more diversified because there are some of those hilly lands. Well, you know, when corn went to $7 a bushel, some farmers thought it was appropriate to raise crops on that hilly land. But mostly, they're still in native prairie. On our own farm in North Dakota, 900 acres is still in native prairie. It's never been plowed. And then everything west of the Missouri River is short grass prairie. And that's much more of an animal-based agriculture. I mean, they still grow crops, which are primarily for feed for animals. So you don't want to suggest that everybody ought to manage their soil in exactly the same way in each of those three regions. You have to adapt to the local ecology. And the question we all have to ask is, how can we have an agriculture that's regenerative? In other words, the resources that we use get renewed in the process of using them. And again, soil is critical in that. And how can we design an agriculture that's more resilient? And that's where the diversity comes in. And, you know, another really interesting resource here is Laura Lenyek published a new book called Resilient Agriculture. The subtitle of the book is Cultivating Food Systems for a Changing Climate. And what she did was went out and interviewed farmers all over the United States who are already making these adaptations to climate change, most of it based on a unique kind of diversity that's appropriate to their own places. And I can't remember, it's like 20 or 25 farmers from around the United States. And each of those farmers tell the story of what they have done now on their own farms to diversify the system to make it more resilient in the face of the unstable climate, really kind of weird weather patterns that we're starting to see. And each of them are based on diversities, but diversities that are unique to their ecology and to their place. So there's some models out there already, you know, that we're seeing that that I think can work.
Everything is adjusted and adapted to local regions and doing what they do best. That's one of the many reasons that North Dakota is not going to be producing oranges.
Right. Exactly.
And so when people are are going to be saying, well, gee, I really want to support my local production. But there also doesn't there have to be a respect for the fact that the local production is going to do some crops better that are better suited than others. But there's other reasons too.
Yeah, I don't think that any of this means that we're not going to do any trading anymore. I think there will be some trading. But the other thing is, I think we're also going to move toward a future where in each of these bioregions, we begin to develop a food system, you know, that's appropriate to that region so that we'll eat more food from what we have decided based on the health of that local ecology is most appropriate to that. And that raises another really interesting thing, and that is the whole issue of human health. And you know, Daphne Miller, who is a healthcare professional out in California and has also teaches family medicine at the University of California, and she wrote a book a number of years ago called The Jungle Effect. She and her husband, I've forgotten where it was, they traveled to some region where people were still eating from mostly their food from their local region based on, you know, what had been appropriate to produce in that region. And the health of those people was simply dramatically better than the health of the people in California where she was. And she became convinced that part of that had to do with, you know, people eating from their local regions, adapting to that, and their health being maintained more effectively that way. So again, if you think about that in terms of where our industrial food system has gone now, you know, where the food's all fast, convenient, and cheap, and it comes from who knows wherever, and much of it is now what we call junk food. And as we know, our healthcare costs have spiraled up. You know, back in 1960, we were spending 5.2% of GDP on healthcare, and now we're spending 18%. So all of these things get connected, and, you know, we're still going to have to explore all of the appropriate, you know, post-neocaloric food systems going to be like. But the good news, I think, is that there are some examples out there that we can and the other thing is, and Daphne Miller has written a new article now, which she published in Yes Magazine, in which she makes, again, based on her own observation as a physician, that one of the key things in terms of health is for people to eat food from healthy soil, and that has significant positive health-promoting effects.
Well, you know, Fred, that's an interesting one, too, because that's turned out to be somewhat controversial. I can see people listening to you explain this and saying that I want to eat food from healthy soils, and when they hear Dr. Daphne Miller and her results, too, but it's hard to go to a store, and they may say non-GMO or organic or sustainably produced. It might say something, but it's just all over the place.
John Takaro's bioregionalism concept makes so much sense because, you know, then it's not simply the eaters having to try to figure out where they're going to get the kind of food that they want. And it's not just about the farmers being told they have to do something. It's people doing this together. I think that is an important social aspect of all of this. So if you, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at Dan Barber's, still relatively new, it came out a couple of years ago, called The Third Plate.
Yes.
And Dan Barber, he went to culinary school in France and already learned from chefs in France that the way to get the best tasting food in your restaurant is to find farmers who manage their soil for soil health. Because if you get food from that healthy soil, then all you need to do as a chef is to prepare it in a way that allows the natural flavors to express themselves. You don't have to manipulate it a lot. And Dan became convinced by that based on his own experience. And this is how he operates his, the Blue Hill restaurant now. I've eaten Dan's food and, it's fantastic. But here's the interesting thing that he points out in the third plate. That, you know, when he went to a farmer to buy a particular product because that product coming from that healthy soil was such good flavor, and an example that he uses in the book quite a bit is Klaus Martin's farm in upstate New York. And Klaus Martin was producing this variety of emmer wheat that was just out of this world. And so he was buying this emmer wheat from him. And then, as Dan always does, he eventually went up to visit the farm and spend some time with Klaus to see, you know, how he did that. And then he realized that in order for Klaus to get this kind of quality soil for this variety of emmer wheat, he had to grow some cover crops from which he got no input at all, no income at all. He had to grow some other crops in the rotation, like barley and millet, for which there was no food market. So he had to sell them as animal feed, and he got paid less for that. And then Dan said to himself, you know, this, I can't do this anymore. I can't expect Klaus, you know, to do all of this and have all of this expense to have this healthy soil to produce this emmer wheat. I have to learn how to eat from the whole farm. And so he started to work with Klaus, and they figured out that one of the cover crops that Klaus was using was a variety of oats. And the oats, you know, when it gets to a milky stage, you tend to then incorporate that into the soil, and all of that, you know, feeds the soil. But then Dan realized that you could harvest the milky seed from that green oats and make an incredible drink that he could serve in a restaurant. So now Klaus can harvest the seed from that oats before he incorporates it back into the soil, and provides Dan with this incredible quality of liquid that he can serve in the restaurant. So this is a concept, again, a social concept, where if we began in each of our regional, bioregional communities to figure out, you know, how to restoring the health of the soil is a foundational fact that we have to do, then how do we all work together to make that work? And one of the things is to learn, you know, to as much as possible to eat from the whole farm, which the farmers have to grow in order to get that healthy soil.
You know, Fred, you've just covered so much ground, and I want to have you come back and talk with us again, because I can't think of anyone more interesting to have the table talk about farm to table than you. The things you covered here today, I mean, connecting the soil and what's the history of it and how soil health matters, you've mentioned that consumers can see that connection to. You mentioned several books that you said that people should check out. I like that. You said one of them was How to Thrive in the Next Economy. And who was the author of that?
John Takara, T-H-A-C-K-A-R-A.
You also mentioned Dan Barber's Third Plate, which is a really good book. You mentioned Daphne Miller. And Dr. Daphne Miller, you said that there's an article in Yes Magazine.
Yeah, Yes Magazine.
Had a book too.
And then the earlier book that she wrote is called The Jungle Effect. And then she wrote a second book after that, which is entitled Pharmacology, spelled F-A-R-M, not P-H-A-R-M, as you might expect from the physician. And in that book, she talked about how she learned how to be a more effective physician from farmers who were doing integrated pest management. Because farmers who did integrated pest management, you know, instead of waiting until a pest emerged and then going to try to get rid of the pest, they figured out how to manage their farms to prevent the pests from emerging in the first place. And she said, that's how we should do medicine.
Did you also mention another book? Was it How to Thrive in New Agriculture?
Yeah. Laura Lenyek, and the title of her book is Resilient Agriculture.
Okay.
And the subtitle is Cultivating Food Systems for a Changing Climate.
I just really want to thank you. I say you're a gentleman and a visionary, and I know you have a big calendar of appearances, and people will have a chance to come and hear you talk at some meetings around the country, and I hope they do, and I'm just glad you're out speaking and sharing these ideas, and I'm glad you shared these ideas with us this morning on Farm to Table Talk.
Well, it was my pleasure, and you had great questions, so that always makes it easy for conversation. So,
thanks, Fred.